So yeah. Of course you would make, you know, take advantage of what's available.
He sat up in his opened window, looking quietly down at the path. A firefly flew in his room and flew right out again. Down jumped the prince, and he went again to find his radio.
This is Tommy Keen, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
The views expressed by on-air volunteer hosts do not reflect the views of Wavefarm or WGXC. WGXC is nonpartisan and does not endorse or support political candidates. To participate in WGXC's on-air dialogue, call 518-622-2598 to either call in live to the studio or record a 3-minute message for broadcast expressing your point of view. Or send an email to info@wgxc.org.
Columbia County Sanctuary Movement is a nonprofit organization based in Columbia County that organizes alongside immigrants and allies to collectively support, empower, and defend our communities. CCSM offers programs that assist newly arrived individuals, including food programs, mutual aid funds, legal support services, and opportunities to organize and be an activist. You can find more information on social media at CCSMNY or by calling 518-303-3848.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of William Chierston of Newark, New Jersey. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
We put together a little composition, and it's got two titles, but they're sort of connected. The first title is The Concord Blues, and the second title is The Grapes Are Ready.
Hey everyone, welcome to Meant to Ferment on WGXC Accra 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. My name is Rebecca Echevarria and I will be your host for this show. This show explores all things fermentation in the Hudson Valley through interviews with practitioners, along with a bit of music inspired by their work. Today, I am super grateful to welcome Todd Cavallo of Wild Arc Farm to the show. Wild Arc is based at the entrance to the Shawangunks in Pine Bush and produces celebrated beverages across the spectrum, from wines to ciders to liquors. Todd and Crystal, and he runs with his wife, Crystal Cornish, who is here today just as a supportive presence on the show. Todd and Crystal minimize human intervention in their production by employing biodynamic practices, eschewing chemical inputs or additives, and abstaining from filtering or fining. Rather, local microflora and ecologies are venerated through the cultivation of native yeasts and incorporation of hybrid heirloom and Vitis vinifera grape varieties. Wild Arc centers the vineyard and thus the microbes within it as part of a larger ecosystem that imparts unique flavors and aromas to their products. Renowned for bringing Piquette to the commercial market, Wild Arc builds upon the storied past of winemaking in New York through their deep knowledge and continuous exploration of the sensory possibilities within alcoholic fermentation. I think I came across Wild Arc for the first time at the Hudson Valley Fermentation Festival, where I picked up a collection of your Piquettes, which maybe we'll touch on. But more recently, I was able to try a bottle of your Florescence, which is a botanical spritzer made from organic Concord grapes grown in the Finger Lakes, so I included this song, which has two titles, Concord Blues and The Grapes Are Ready, by Bob Wilbur and Kenny DeVerne's group Soprano Summit, recorded live at the Concord Jazz Festival in 1976. So welcome to the show, Todd.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm very excited to be here and to chat. And this is a great song. I hadn't heard it before, but it's going in rotation for sure.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for being here. I know you've had a very busy last couple of weeks. You were at the Big Little Fair in New York City, which celebrates natural wine, sustainable wine producers and ferments, and then the Craft Beverage Festival this past weekend in New Paltz. How did it go?
It went great. Yeah, it's always a fun opportunity to get in front of a lot more people in New York and show them New York beverages and what we're all doing. And then it's also just fun to hang out with each other and kind of commiserate at the end of harvest with the rest of the makers that we know and love so much. So yeah, they were both great opportunities to do that. And people responded well. It's always, people are often surprised at what's happening here in New York in the wine world, and we're happy to be able to show them some of what we think is fun about what's going on right now.
Sure. Yeah, are most of the folks who are attending, are they based like regionally or mostly from New York or some folks from out of state?
The Big Little Wine Fair is very focused on New York producers and then New York wine and beverage professionals in New York City, because we think that it's very important for the regions around the biggest kind of natural wine consuming city maybe in the world to have access to us in one place. And then the Craft Beverage Fest is a little bit more consumer-focused, but then that's when we get to see the local Hudson Valley folks who love local craft beverages come in and see what we're all doing across, not just wine, but, beer, spirits, rice wine, other
kombucha,
other fun fermented beverages all over the state.
Yeah, and it's an amazing timing, too, I guess, for the producers who are coming into a different transition of the season, and also for consumers who are starting their hibernation pattern again.
Yeah, stock those fridges for winter so you've got everything you need.
Yeah.
And yeah, we it was a little cold and windy, so we were happy to have some of our new spirits on offer to warm people from the inside.
Totally. Definitely. Well, I'm glad to hear it all went well, and maybe you'll be able to take a bit of a breather soon, but
Pretty soon. Yeah. One more press load and we're done pressing, and then we just have a lot of bottling to do, which is nonstop work also.
Sure, yes. It never ends, I guess, for the winemakers of this region particularly. And also just a note on the music. I mean, I was excited. Music is one of my favorite parts of putting together these shows, and I was excited to see that it also seems to intersect with your practice because you're incorporating it into the names of some of your bottles. Lemon of Pink, Book Song, Sweetheart, which I read was kind of an homage to your old punk band, and a new release.
Short-lived, yes. Short-lived band, but that was a fun one, yeah.
And a new release of Harvest Moon in Arabic, but...
Yeah, yeah. I love Neil Young, so that's definitely a nod in there for sure.
Yes. Did it come about organically, or do you see music as kind of a natural companion to wine?
It was another part of my life for a long time. I played music in bands all throughout high school and college and after, and was lucky enough to be able to travel a little bit while I was playing music after college. And in that traveling, I was in Europe, and I was introduced to drinking cultures in Spain and in France, where it was a little different than what I was used to here in the U.S. So definitely that was a lot of my journey into learning about how wine as a cultural product is enjoyed elsewhere in the world. And because I was there doing music, it was, staying in some, Italian guy's basement, and then he brings down a bottle of his uncle's wine that comes from their backyard, and it's something that's not precious. It's just, this is what we drink, this is what we have, this is what we always have and have always had.
Sure.
So it's always been kind of connected in that way, and I still feel, connected to the world of music and try to keep up, but I don't necessarily know what's happening as much anymore since I spend so much time on the wine side of things.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear how it was kind of like a co-evolution of those two types of, I mean, really expression.
Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
And communication.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I was excited to see that. And we'll have a song of yours on the show or that you contributed to the show. And, yeah, so we'll transition into that and then have our discussion. And I'm super excited to chat with you.
Me too. Can't wait.
Thanks so much.
حدنا نحن أبطال الخمار هيدي ورقة جدنا
مين بيسكر قدنا مين يهدي حدنا نحن أبطال الخمار هيدي ورقة جدنا
البحر بتجيبه لقدامك لما بتشرب كاس البحر بتجيبه لقدامك لما بتشرب كاس بتشوف الدنيا جميلة مليانة أحسان مين يطال جبالنا مين براح جبالنا مين يطال جبالنا مين براح جبالنا نسكر عموالنا وغير هيك ما بدنا
مين بيسكر قدنا مين يهدي حدنا نحن أبطال الأمارة هيدي وردة جنة
وهالشب اللي جاي الخبي عتافو حاطط الأمين بجيبه والكاس عشفافو مين وهالشب اللي جاي الخبي عتافو حاطط الأمين والكاس عشفافه مدد هيدا زحلاوي والسكرة راسه ضاوي مدد هيدا زحلاوي والسكرة راسه ضاوي ناوي يسكرنا ناوي ونحنا هيك بدنا
مين بيسكر قدنا مين يهدي حدنا نحنا أبطال الأمارة هيدي وردة جدنا
ستر جي حزب مرتب ما في عنا ضرب يا جماعة اسمعوا مني حزبي أحلى حزب ستر جي حزب مرتب ما في عنا ضرب بس بتاكل أنيني لما تطلع لديني بس بتاكل أنيني لما تطلع لديني برجع إلا تهديني والله يرحم جدنا
مين بيذكر أبنا مين يهدي حدنا نحن أبطال الخمارة هيدي وردة جدنا
مين بيسكر قدنا مين يهدي حدنا نحن أبطال الخمارة هيدي وردة جدنا
نحن أبطال الخمارة هيدي وردة جدنا
على هاوية أنا مش موجود الوتر وجعفة خشب لك بعزف على العود على هوية أني مش موجود الوتر وشمفة خشبي عندي بارود بلا جنسية ولا عندي حدود وإذا تسألني قل لك بعزف على العود
So we are back, and we just heard a couple of songs. One song that I found, I felt was inspired by Todd and Crystal's practice, and then another that Todd contributed. So the first song was called Min Biskarkana. I apologize in advance for my pronunciation, which I think roughly translates to Who's as Drunk as Us, or that's as much as I could find from my research, but if it seems like from different renditions and videos I've explored online, kind of like an homage to Iraq, which Todd and Crystal make at Wild Ark Farm. It is by a Lebanese musician, Tony Farah, released in 1993. And then Todd contributed the next song. Do you want to speak to...
Sure, yeah. It's a band called Tutard, which means strawberry in Arabic. They are based in the occupied Golan Heights, and that song specifically, Laissez Passer, speaks to their inability to have any state documentation and travel papers. And so Laissez Passer is just what they say when they, you know, come to a checkpoint. You got to let them by. They're not citizens of the occupying state. They're not citizens of anywhere. And the Golan Heights actually is one of the biggest wine-growing regions in the area, and a lot of those wines grown in occupied territory are imported here into the U.S., and we should maybe think about what we're buying and drinking, especially if we're trying to adhere to BDS and not support anything made in the occupied territories.
Sure. Yeah. No. It's. I mean, very powerful to be cognizant of all these intersecting systems that are can be contributing to violence and destruction all over the world, and they infiltrate in industries that we might not be totally familiar with or, sure, or expect yeah. when we're going yeah. to a wine store, yeah. and being yeah cognizant of that can be our yeah. There's power in that.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so I loved hearing that song, and I feel like in a lot of the work that you do, you incorporate the Levant comes in, or especially in a new release that I mentioned. Again, I'm going to butcher the translation in Arabic, but it means Harvest Moon in Arabic.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, Kamar al-Hisad, which I'll apologize as well because yeah. I'm not a native speaker, but I'm practicing. But yeah, my grandmother was Palestinian, and I grew up with mostly the food as my touch point for the culture. And as I've gotten more and more into, you know, learning about the history of fermentation in the Levant and, you know, the birthplace of distillation as we know it, that's why we started making the Arak in 2020 first, when we lost my grandmother, as kind of an homage to her. And it's named after her grandmother, Nasr Amitri, who was born in Nazareth. Yeah, it's you know, it's an interesting way to kind of weave our cultural history into the practice that we're making here in New York State, which is far, far away from the Galilee.
Yes, and that hearing that makes me think about like memory making, or how we're kind of keeping, I don't know, just like retaining memory is so sure. challenging, or I feel like it's challenging. And as like generational, you know, with the speed of life, I don't know, all accelerated, but I just feel like that's feels like such a potent way to yeah make and memory.
They say, you know, they say scent is one of the strongest you know, arbiters of memory making, and the first wine that we named with an Arabic name was Kamar al-Din, which is also the name of a dried apricot paste that my grandmother
yes.
would just bring us, you know, forever growing up. It was always in the pantry. Whenever we needed a sweet treat, we would, you know, pull that out and have a little square of this apricot paste. And one year, a few years back, we were blending all of our kind of orange wine barrels to make our new orange wine blend, and it smelled exactly like that apricot paste. And so I said, we're going to borrow the name. And there's actually a beverage you can make blending the apricot paste with water and ice, which they also call Kamar al-Din or Kamar Din or Kamar.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we made a wine version of that, which is, you know, a little different. But yeah, that memory of that scent was what brought me there originally. And so that's why we started kind of doing this orange wine every season with some moon reference, mostly Arabic name. And the new one that we just put out is Hilal, which is crescent moon, which is their not new moon, like empty moon, but crescent moon is the symbol of kind of rebirth and regeneration in the Swana region. And so yeah, we've just tried to kind of keep that up and keep iterating on an idea that came from that memory, that original sense memory of the scent of my favorite candy from my grandmother.
Yeah, that's beautiful. There's so much that you can bring into your, you know, creative work and into wines. I mean, to hear about the stories and intention and histories behind a bottle can
yeah.
really shine through.
Yeah. And then there's a movement lately to kind of, you know, not necessarily demystify wine, but to kind of break it out of its, you know, cage of kind of colonial Western European worldviews. And a big part of that is like, why do all of the, you know, known references for scents and the touch points of, you know, gooseberry and all of these things have to be so European when there are, you know, dozens of tropical fruit flavors from,
sure.
you know, Southeast Asia or from the Caribbean that might be better references for a lot of these super tropical white wines. And so, yeah, that's always something that I like to keep in mind is like, you know, let's get out of the fixed, you know, this is the list of what you should and could smell in a wine, and get out to like, what does this evoke for you when you smell this wine? What memories does it bring up for you? What does it smell like from your childhood?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily like, do you know what you're supposed to smell in
sure.
this wine?
Yeah.
And that's something that this, you know, native ferment, natural wine, hybrid grape world broadens a lot, too, because they're bringing in a lot of new scents and flavors and ideas of what wine can be and should be.
Yeah. So it seems like it creates an opportunity for it to keep expanding and to keep, yeah, kind of, I don't know, to be expansive, not to be so linear and narrow or definitive
or reductive. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And then it's like, what if you don't like artichokes or like if it's bringing up or spin, I don't know. Like, yeah, it feels like, yeah, why not connect to something that has a more internal resonance? And then that will also help with retaining it, because I feel like as I'm learning about wine, it's really learning a new language and learning a new language on the tongue almost, or connecting to senses that we're just not maybe inclined to or used to, or we didn't necessarily grow up with that. But yeah, so why not start from an expansive place with that, with learning that new language, rather than starting from that is this, this is that.
You yeah, know, so. Exactly. I think that's probably a pretty apt metaphor for language learning, too. Like, some people may have an inability to have a kind of a fixed view of things and to learn a language as, like, this, this, and this, you know, in order, and being able to be more, you know, relational with ideas and words coming in, or, you know, in this case, with scents and flavors coming in is an easier way for a lot of people, I think, to come to something. And hey, that's what we want. We want everything to be approachable and accessible.
Yeah. Have a personal relationship. Yeah. But I guess, yeah, mentioning the relational essence of it all, you've been working here since 2016, making wine in the Hudson Valley in Orange County. And through that time, you've really had different collaborations, different interactions with winemakers, and also makers across the spectrum of cider, etc. But I was interested in particularly, I guess, being in this place. It's, you know, has a storied history of winemaking. You're not sure. far from the oldest winery in the country, Brotherhood Winery, the oldest vineyard in the country, Benmarle and Marlborough. So I think that really speaks to like the potential of grape cultivation in this region and to produce, you know, distinct and quality wines. And I was interested in your experiences working with the land, because I know cold weather, climate, the soils, and how that is discernible, again, through taste, through terroir, mm-hmm. is a powerful conversation in the wine
sure.
world.
Yeah.
And being in this place, how does that, what have you found being a winemaker in a colder climate region like New York?
The biggest thing is that our growing season is the full year. So in California, what happens in the winter doesn't necessarily affect the next crop of grapes. I mean, rainfall, sure, you know, and how much water holding capacity the soil has there has an influence. But here, what happens in the winter can make or break a season. So, you know, all the talk about, oh, global warming, isn't that good for you? You can grow Cabernet Sauvignon in New York now, and you can ripen grapes better. It's not necessarily that we're seeing like a gradual increase in annual temperature or growing degree days, is what they call them. But what we are seeing are these wild swings, the same things that are influencing all of the increase in, you know, hurricanes and storms worldwide. Those wild swings are what are dangerous for viticulture, because if we have a late frost in May, which happened a few years ago,
yes.
after bud break, then you could lose your entire crop because everything has come out and then suddenly it's all dead. And there are secondary shoots and buds that will come out, but a lot of times those can be damaged as well. But also generally, if there's a warmer winter, then bud break can be a lot earlier than it used to be. So it could just happen before the last frost even happens. And then we've got, you know, if we're getting, you know, early cold snaps before the vines have fully hardened off for the season, then you can actually have vine damage at that point. And then, yeah, we're still having those wild temperature swings where you can get just trunk cracking from, you know, if you've got moisture in solid wood and you've got a sub, you know, 20 degree below zero day, those vines can just split and be, you know, killed back to the ground.
Mm.
A lot of times they'll send up a new shoot the next year. A lot of times people are training new canes every season. That's one of the ways that we mitigate it here, is that we do cane pruning instead of spur pruning, which... simplest explanation is, instead of, you know, taking the vine from the ground up and then just leaving little spurs to start new shoots every year, you're actually taking a brand new cane from the trunk and you're making that your new cane, and then the buds on that become the new spurs. And that's just a way of protecting yourself from, if your cane dies, then you've got no fruit for the year. So if you've got a couple extra canes and you're training new ones every season, you're more likely to get a decent crop from the vineyard for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of viticultural things that we do in the vineyard. You know, we have to still hill up our graft unions. Most of our vines are grafted. Again, it's a longer story, but you know, in the late 1800s, there was a louse that threatened to kill all the vines all
phylloxera.
Over the world. Yeah, phylloxera. And they studied it for years and tried to figure out ways to save the vines. And that's actually where the first hybrid grapes of European and American grapes were started to be created. And they thought that was going to be the solution, because the American grapes weren't susceptible. And so they were hybridizing these grapes and planting them and finding, okay, these are surviving. We can make wine from them. It's different. It's not the same wine that we're used to, because the varieties aren't the same.
Hmm.
And then a gentleman in Texas discovered that you could graft the vinifera, the European vines, on top of American rootstocks. And they would still grow the European grapes.
But
the rootstock and the roots were what were most susceptible to the louse.
Hmm.
And so having those American rootstocks protected them. And so then most of the European wine growing regions immediately threw out all the American hybrid grapes and said, no, you can't plant those anymore. We figured it out. We're doing it this way. We're keeping our own, you know, our heritage grapes, or whatever they wanted to say, and grafting them onto American rootstock. That's a long story to say that most vines in the world are now grafted. And so those graft unions are the most cold susceptible part of the vine. And so we have to, at the end of every season, hill up soil onto them to kind of protect them. It's basically just putting a blanket of soil around that thermally protects them a few degrees above ambient temperature. And so, yeah, those are all the viticultural things that we kind of have to contend with, or a few of them anyway. I'm sure there are many, many more.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, growing in a colder climate also affects what kind of wines we can make. The sugar accumulation, you know, comes from the sun at the end of the season when the grapes have started to ripen, and we can't get, you know, those 14-15% wines that you can get in the West Coast or in a lot of European regions, and our acidity tends to be a lot higher. And so at Wild Arc Farm, anyway, we focus on making wines that highlight that, wines that are fresh, that are lighter, that go great with food. I like to say New York wines are, you know, best for the table. It's something that's part of a meal or a celebration or a repast, or that you share with your friends and family. And so, yeah, we just focus on letting the wines do what they want to do here, instead of trying to figure out ways to get them to emulate wines from elsewhere in the world.
Rather than like continually seeking that expression and then having to, again, like you said, go back with all the decisions that are made about cultivation to really, I mean, it sounds like it would be such a, I don't know, feels tense, like a strain to force the land to react and operate in a way to define the expression of the grapes through the wine. It's just like,
right, yeah, then you're just fighting.
Yeah.
I mean, agriculture is always fighting against nature, and like no matter how organic and regenerative your agriculture is, planting a single crop, even if you've got, you know, interplanted crops or a permaculture food forest or whatever, it's not what nature would do there, and it's not what nature wants to be there.
Sure.
So you're never going to be, you know, better than nature. You're always going to be fighting against nature. And so we try to minimize that as much as we can by letting nature kind of do as much as it can in the process.
So,
you know, native plants on the vineyard floor, not mowing often or at all if we can avoid it.
And how you're working with, I've read that you were, you know, kind of working with growers to help them either transition into organic practices or incorporate more organic practices. And then thinking about that, I was wondering, because, you know, microbes are present in every stage of the process, from the grapes to the vines, and that then translates into the wine. And, you know, with more organic practices, there's an assumption that you would have more like robust, diverse microbial communities on both of those components.
Yeah.
And so then I felt like you were really looking at winemaking from a microbiogeographical perspective, like starting from those initial microbial communities by having that collaboration with growers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I agree with that. It is something that people will argue about for sure, but I will put forth my ideas, which is, yeah, exactly that. There are people who will always say, like, there's no such thing as a native fermentation. You'll have yeast that colonizes your winery and that becomes your yeast. And if you've ever had commercial wine or anything in your space, that commercial yeast is so powerful it will take over.
Mm.
My argument against that in my space is that all of our fermentations happen outside. We don't have room in our winery space. So when we bring grapes in during harvest season, the macro bins sit outside in the open air. And then there are two studies that are often referenced. I forget which is which. There was one in Australia and one in Oregon where they were basically swabbing every part of the winery, all the equipment, all the harvesting equipment, you know, people's snippers, people's hands who are doing the harvesting, vineyard soil, and basically looking at the population of yeast that were in all of those things they swabbed pre-harvest and then matching that to what happened in the fermentation. And the only one-to-one connection of a specific Saccharomyces strain that they could find was from the soil of the vineyard.
Yeah.
And that soil Saccharomyces yeast that they found was present in the fermentations. And, you know, maybe I'll have to find that study so we can reference it for folks so they don't think I'm making this up.
Yeah, no.
But, yeah,
no,
I truly believe in that. And if you believe in terroir, which is another big kind of bugaboo that people love to argue about, I think the biggest part of terroir, besides the climate in the region, is what is present in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
What microbiological, both Saccharomyces, but also all of the, you know, the lactic acid bacteria that do the malolactic fermentation. Those come in with the grapes. Those are coming from the soil as well. And then part of our organic spray practices is we spray a lot of biological antifungals, things that are lactobacillus-based or other lactic acid bacteria that either outcompete the bad fungus, the things that we don't want on the grapes, the black rot and the downy and powdery mildew, or they create metabolites that are antagonistic to those diseases.
Mm.
And so we're using these natural those things were also all identified in vineyards and in soil and then tested in labs and figured out, you know, hey, this works.
Sure.
So we're spraying those things in addition to compost tea, which is, let's take the compost that we build here that builds up its own yeast and bacterial strains, and let's oxygenate that, put it in water, and let that start to recolonize the leaf surfaces and the vineyard floor.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're very big on trying to keep those groups of microbiota alive in the vineyard, and then that's what our native ferments hopefully are leaning on to make the wines.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you mentioned lactobacillus as kind of an agent in the vineyard, because I was also learning about malolactic fermentation, which I think is a feature. I forget on your current offerings which bottles are you know, kind of reflect that, but I had never heard of this phrase before. Malolactic fermentation is the conversion of malic acid, which is, you know, like as said, as a green apple tart.
Yeah, malus
taste.
Like apple. Yeah.
Yes, and into lactic acid, which of course you find in cheese, milk, and it's done by this particular bacteria. And again, I'm gonna the pronunciation was hard to find, like Onuccus Oni.
Onococcus Oni. Onococcus Oni. Yeah, yeah. I think there are also some lactobacillus strains and some, I forget what it is, the Higardi. There's another lactic acid bacteria that are found often. And you can buy commercial malolactic fermentation strains when you're trying to do it yourself. And, you know, just for people who might not know, almost every red wine you'll ever drink has naturally or been inoculated with to go through malolactic fermentation. And most white wines have not or do not, commercial white wines, other than Chardonnay, which is very famously known in some categories of being kind of buttery,
velvety,
lactic, rounded. And so, you know, when we're making a Riesling that goes natively through malolactic fermentation, it can be confusing for people to pour them a Riesling that's got that broader kind of almost milky lactic palate, even if it's got the, you know, the lemon and lime pith of a Riesling as the primary flavor and scent components.
Yes.
But yeah, we just, you know, we're not using much sulfur, if at all. Sometimes we use a little bit of sulfur, but I'd say probably 60% of our wines in the past few years have had zero added sulfites. And so if you're not filtering and using enough sulfites to kill off those lactic acid bacterial strains, then you're going to get malolactic.
It's going to happen.
Usually in the spring for us when they warm up after primary is done and they've overwintered in the cold barn.
Yeah. So with that Riesling that you mentioned, that's the 2024 Riesling CDC. Was that, that must have been an intentional decision. I mean, how did you come about deciding that bottle is going to have, this process is going to be a feature incorporated into this bottle?
We didn't really decide it as much as it happened.
Yes.
We made Riesling for the first time in 2017 from a different vineyard. The Clos de Cochon vineyard that you mentioned is a super special vineyard on Cayuga Lake that has been farmed organically since it was planted by Giuseppe. He's a printer by day whose family farm had all this extra land when they stopped farming pigs and cows. And so this old pig pasture that had been fallow for 10 years, he said, let's see how Riesling grows there.
Wow.
And he said, yeah, we call it the Clos de Cochon as a joke. And I said, that's definitely what we're going to call it on the label. And so we've bought all the grapes that he's produced there for the last 5 years. And so that was our first access to like a really special single vineyard site that we're very proud to be able to keep working with. But the first Riesling that we had made from another site on Seneca Lake had naturally gone through malolactic fermentation in 2017, and at the time I was like, well, this doesn't taste like the Rieslings that I like learned to love. It tastes completely different. It tastes like if somebody made Riesling out of Chardonnay.
Okay.
And yeah, it took me a minute to say, like, actually, you know what, this is what this Riesling wants to be. And you know, drinking it over the course of multiple vintages from that new site, I've come to really love that expression of it. But it is atypical, so it's, you know, that's why we tend to talk about it and explain it, because we don't want people to be surprised. And, you know, there are people who still consider Riesling to be always a sweet wine. And
yes.
So we can't really bottle a sweet wine because, again, if you put existing sugar in a bottle
very
without filtering out the yeast and the bacteria, it'll just keep fermenting. It'll be carbonated.
Yes.
We don't have really any sweet wines. Which, you know, I don't have anything against sweet wine. I think that's another problem with it, this kind of demonization of residual sugar in wines or sweet wines. I think people can make sweet wines in a natural way, especially if they're, you know, in California where they're getting, you know, Zinfandel that can be up to 17%. That's a big, you know, heavy, high alcohol sweet wine, which is not to my palate, but I don't think there's anything wrong with enjoying sweet wine. I think if that's your thing, or if that's a gateway to bring people into wine to make something that's more palatable, I love it. Let it rip.
Yeah, and I was listening, like I mentioned, to this book, Wine Simple by Aldo Sam, and he was saying that there is just with Riesling, I mean, with any wine, there is like a spectrum. You know, it can get sweet, it can be very dry. It just, there is, so you're maybe just operating on this spectrum and offering kind of a new perspective on the possibilities of these grapes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we do have, I mean, we're making a Pommeau that's been in barrel for a couple of years. We'll probably release it after one more year. That's, you know, 17% and a lot of residual sugar because you're putting spirits and fresh juice into a barrel at the percentage where the yeast can't ferment any further.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll have some sweet stuff to release. And our spirits all have some little bit of back sweetening, too. So I love being able to have something sweet to pour for someone if they're asking for a little sugar.
Sure. Is the Pommeau, is that a co-ferment as well or no?
No, that's just apples. Well, it's multiple varieties of apple.
Okay.
Which is what we would call a co-ferment in the wine world sometimes. Co-ferment is, a pretty broad topic for sure.
Yes.
Which I love talking about because we do a lot of different types of co-ferment.
Yeah, so for anyone who might not be familiar, co-fermentation involves the simultaneous fermentation of two or more grape varieties or even other fruits. I wonder, I guess it must translate to the cider. I don't know.
It's funny. I never really thought about it, but they don't talk about it in the same way because a lot of,
every cider would be a co-fermentation.
It's very rare to have a single varietal cider. It's becoming more common now, and I think that's likely due to the influence of the wine world and people starting to recognize that cider is wine as well, which it is, which I love to, tell people, think about cider more as a agricultural product or as a wine and less akin to, a beer or hard seltzer or something that's maybe less thoughtful when you're drinking it. Not beer. Beer is very thoughtful as well. I shouldn't say that.
A lot of brewer
friends that I love.
Yeah.
Cider is, it can be very, it can be single orchard, it can be single varietal, or it can be blended and still be beautiful. And in those blended cases, they technically don't really refer to it as a co-ferment. They're just saying, we're blending all of the apples that we love from this orchard or from across multiple sources to make the most delicious cider we can and using the balance of acidity and tannin and sugar to make a balanced product.
And then the blending is distinct in the winemaking process because blending refers to having finished wines and then blending them at the end, but co-fermentation can bring up kind of new flavor, unexpected flavor, just bring about like almost a new chemistry, wine flavors that wouldn't show up if you were blending two varieties.
Bigger picture stuff again is, wine, grape wine and cider are both the most common fermented beverages in the world because those fruits have the most advantageous chemistry for fermentation. Mm. They have enough acid that there isn't a big problem with bacterial spoilage. They have enough sugar that they can make enough alcohol to be shelf stable once they're done. And then there's not enough other, weird fermentable byproducts that come from fermenting their juices.
Hmm.
There's something to be said about single variety fermentations being very fixed in their chemistry. For example, we make a wine we call Blackbird, which is a co-fermentation of a red hybrid called Noiré and Riesling. And in that case, that red hybrid on its own can be a little bit much. It's very peppery, but it's also very like deep, deep red and unctuous and fruity. And lightening it up with a little bit of the white both allows for the fermentation to be a little bit more even and the final product to be a little more even. But also, the anthocyanins that are present in red grape skins,
the red pigments in red wine,
are not present in the same way in white grapes. And so, we've got orange wine, which has become more popular in the last 10 or 20 years, even though it's an ancient product. And there are, I forget, there's, I'm going to probably just be making this up now, but I think there are five compounds that are anthocyanin or related in red grape skins. And there are two similar compounds that are tanninish or tannin related in white grapes. But if you're macerating white grapes on the skins, you're not going to get the same type of tannin and structure that you would get from macerating red grapes. Mm. But if you're doing them together, you can get the tannin and structure. And there's also people will complain often that there's an inability to make a structured tannic red wine from hybrid grapes.
Mm.
There's a lot of talk and studies around why that is. My most recent understanding is that the protein in the red grape juice from red hybrid grapes works to self-fine the wine. So fining is when you're adding an agent to a wine to kind of settle out something out of solution.
Bacteria and yeast to avoid.
Or tannins.
Or
so
tannins.
White wines you can fine to clarify them, and that's usually done with things like bentonite clay, but there are other commercial additives that people add. And red wines you can often fine because they're too tannic and you want to bind some of those tannins and settle them out. And they'll use things like egg whites or other protein, isinglass is the famous fish bladder one that's not vegan. People aren't using it as much anymore. But protein being the key that binds to those tannins and settles them out of solution, if there's enough protein in your juice, it will basically just fine itself. They'll bind the protein naturally in the juice will bind to those tannins and settle out. And then so there were a couple studies out of Cornell where they started adding extra skins to macerations, and in this case they were adding vinifera skins, vitis vinifera skins to the macerations to try
which are vitis vinifera maybe you already mentioned it earlier, I think, are the
but yeah, those are the grapes that we know the names of European in origin, although
yes.
Now we've learned that they were first cultivated in the Levant 10 to 11,000 years ago and then made their way through a colonial conquest all the way to Western Europe and became the grapes that we know of today as being the most known for wine use. And hybrid grapes are hybridized Vitis vinifera, those European varieties, with American varieties.
Yes.
Vitis riparia and Vitis labrusca being the most common here in the Northeast.
Got it. And you were saying that they found that incorporating the Vitis vinifera skins with a hybrid
allows you to get enough tannin into solution that it doesn't all fine out naturally as easily. And then so the first instance of that I ever saw was our friend Ben at Osmote Wines up in the Finger Lakes had done some hybrid grapes on, I think, first Chardonnay skins and then Cab Franc skins.
Oh.
And then we had actually kind of, starting in 2018, I think, we had done a co-ferment of apples on grape skins.
Hmm.
And those grape skins were vinifera skins as well because we wanted to try to add a little structure and tannin to a non-tannic cider base. So we're using sweet apples. There are bittersweet and bitter sharp apples that have tannin in them, and then the culinary apples that we know don't have a built-in tannin. We're getting deep into the weeds now.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. I think we're coming almost to the end, but it really does speak to like the amount of, I don't know, just creativity and like intentional decisions, and just looking at each stage of the winemaking process offers so much in terms of like the consideration of how it will impact. And with time, you know, you're not going to really know.
We've learned all of this stuff in the short 10 years that we've been doing it, and it's definitely influenced our direction. That's one of the main interests of mine with co-fermentation, is that you can start to play with chemistry in a little bit of interesting ways and try to kind of guide the end product more gently than you would if you're putting, you know, chemical additives and powdered tannin and, you know, sawdust for oak additions.
Sure.
Which, you know, are things that big commercial wineries might do. I don't like this positioning of natural wine versus... I think low intervention wine can be made in a number of ways. And I think there are a lot of people making wine by hand all over the country that may not call themselves natural, even if they may be. They may not like being associated with the movement. But really, for me, it's small, thoughtful, handmade wines versus industrial, you know, supermarket wines made in, you know, million-gallon tanks.
Yeah. In a nutshell, yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Before we tune out, I just wanted to ask, where can folks find you? And if you have any upcoming events to share, anything, upcoming news?
Sure, yeah. Well, we are at Wild Arc Farm, WildArcFarm, on Instagram. We are wildarcfarm.com online. We have a mailing list and a wine club. Our wine club ships out 3 times a year. The mailing list, you can just join if you want to hear every time we have a release, and you can buy a la carte. But everything's available online on our website. And we are distributed nationally, so we're in your favorite shops if they have a good local or organic or natural wine selection. If they don't, it is very helpful to ask for us by name. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, we have a couple more markets before the end of the year. We're doing the Fuller Market in Kingston, their holiday market, which is mid-December. And then we've got Field and Supply Holiday Market down in New York City, December 6th and 7th. So if you want to see us in person and taste, those cool. are some options.
Wonderful. Thank you so, so much for being here. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much.
Great.
Looking forward to trying all that you mentioned. And yeah, so much to explore and flavors to try. So thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Gogona, gogona, gogona. Gogani 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 gogo, gogani gogani gogo na, gogani 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 gogo, gogani gogani gogo na he.
Arkadaş, daha ukarı, daha ukarı.